Sourcing Matters Podcast. This is your host, Aaron Niederhelman, sharing stories of our food. And welcome back to Sourcing Matters. This is your host, Aaron Niederhelman. Did you know that 52% of the U.S. population lives in counties that drain into watersheds? And 39% of total population live in counties that are directly on coastlines? So, as we're 27 days into the longest government shutdown in the modern era, I wanted to find out how a lack of funding for 500,000 federal employees was impacting our oceans, our marine environments, and our waterways. Some research presented numerous articles detailing a plethora of government agencies that are towing their water in their day-to-day. Here's a few. Concerns over clean water programs managed by the EPA were front and center in all the articles. Numerous EPA programs that protected clean water and public health are all suspended. Stuff like wastewater permitting and enforcement of actions against polluters, obviously all off the books. Also affected is the BEACH, B-E-A-C-H, grants program that monitors water quality at thousands of U.S. beaches. And get this, there is one single NOAA staff person that is monitoring harmful algae blooms and red tide and toxic blue algae. At least 70 national parks have closed across the country, while others are unstaffed and festering. We've all seen the pictures of overflowing trash cans and toilets. On the ocean side, NOAA's Office of Marine Sanctuaries, which manages 14 marine protected areas encompassing more than 783,000 square miles, is closed and unable to complete its mandate of protecting our nation's most susceptible ocean ecosystems. Federally supported scientific research has skidded to a halt. Agencies like NOAA, EPA, and the National Science Foundation have stopped conducting research that's critical to sound management of coastal ecosystems. Projects impacted range from coral reefs that study on the Pacific to fishery surveys on the Gulf of Mexico to sea ice monitoring in the Antarctic. So very important climate research programs that are being affected, if you believe in that kind of crazy scientific stuff. Also, we're looking at coastal management issues because of the shutdown. NOAA has suspended its national estuaries, coastal resilience, marine debris, and sea grant programs. These programs protect beaches, rocky shores, wildlife, and help communities plan for sea level risk and extreme weather events. In addition, NOAA's coastal zone management, the CZM programs, which provides grants to 34 state coastal programs, remains unfunded in 2019. Today, we welcome a guest with an impressive background protecting these essential marine resources. He's a dynamo who's ready for a fight when it's needed and has been seeking for his entire career to leave this place better than he found it. Today, we welcome John Bullard, who's the former regional administrator of the Greater Atlantic Region of NOAA Fisheries. Hey, John.
Good to be here, Aaron. Thanks for the invitation.
Hey, it is my pleasure. You are always welcome. And you just returned from a trip to Florida.
Yeah, I'm retired from NOAA. I retired about a year ago. And my family's been vacationing down in Florida over the holidays for about 30 years. So it was nice to get back there.
Not too bad.
Red tide had subsided a little bit, so.
Yeah, I was going to ask, are you the one NOAA employee that just right. The books, yeah, down there looking at the red tide? And you have to be, it's down by Fort Myers that you're at. So are you a Sox fan? Do you go check out the Sox fan?
Yeah, the Sox go down. It's, I don't know how many days it is till spring training, but it's getting close.
Yeah, we got to see the ticker going on, right? Like, right. Look up there, right. And keep us happy. It's like in our mind's eye, it's what we look at as being the first day of spring, even though we're not there. Yeah. Hey, John, tell us a bit more about, from your background, obviously you have an incredible background with NOAA and your previous work. Tell us a bit more of what the government shutdown means for your confidants at NOAA, for our fisheries and for oceans.
Well, NOAA, my previous boss, I worked under at NOAA in the 90s as a political employee for President Clinton and Vice President Gore down in Washington, and then my most recent tour at NOAA as the regional administrator in Gloucester. So I've had about 10 years or so at NOAA. It's a great organization. Kathy Sullivan was one of my bosses, first woman to walk in space, although, as she said, you don't really walk, your feet are pretty useless up there. But she described NOAA as the Environmental Intelligence Agency. It's the largest collector of environmental information. And you collect that environmental information so people can make decisions with it. And as you pointed out in your introduction, Aaron, that environmental information isn't being collected now. And in fisheries management, there are really three steps to managing fisheries. And the first is, and this sounds like common sense, except nowadays nothing's common, is it's in the Magnuson Act. Warren Magnuson, our own Gary Studs, put together the Magnuson Act in 1974. It's been doing wonderful things for over 40 years. Is it should be science-based. And so that's the foundation of managing fisheries, is it should be science-based. And as I say, that should be common sense, but not. Nothing's common anymore.
Right, the introduction of alternative facts.
Right. How about that? Yeah. And so there are surveys that take place where you try and establish how many fish are out there, which sounds like it ought to be easy. You know, counting fish is like counting trees, except as some clever person says, the fish are invisible and they move. So it's not as easy as counting trees.
Right.
And so there's spring surveys and fall surveys. And you can't just delay a survey, you know, by a couple of weeks, because they have to take place at certain times of the year. And so if you can't do it right now and you delay it a month, well, you may have missed a whole year. And the resources at the Woods Hole Science Center are stretched, you know, like a banjo string, really, really tight, because that science center serves the New England Fishery Management Council. It serves the Mid-Atlantic Council. It serves the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission. And everyone fights for those resources, because there are all kinds of stocks, from lobster, which is a $500 million fishery, scallops, another $500 million fishery, cod and flounders, which are stocks in perilous condition. Everyone is clamoring for the science. Congress looks over everyone's shoulders, because all of these are highly political. Mm. Everyone wants more surveys, more stock assessments, more science. And John Hare, Dr. John Hare, who runs the Science Center, it has this battle of how do I satisfy all of these demands. And it's hard enough to do when you have 365 days a year to do that science. And when you take a month and counting and say, well, sorry, you can't do it, you can't just have people come back and say, that's a vacation. No, the work is now backlogged. And as I mentioned, you can't do a spring survey in the summer.
Yeah.
You can't do it in the fall. You can't do it in the winter. You've lost a whole year. Yeah. So it is a very critical loss. Now, why are we suffering this loss? We're suffering this loss because we're told there's an emergency on the southern border. Now, before, when I worked at NOAA before I was retired, I was supposed to be careful with my words. I never was, but I was supposed to be. Now I'm retired. I don't have to be careful. Well, a crisis on the southern border is a manufactured crisis. Well, there are crises that aren't manufactured. And the amount of cod around here is not a manufactured crisis. Climate change and what it is doing to fish stocks is not a manufactured crisis. The fact that there are a little over 400 North Atlantic right whales now in decline, probably only 100 breeding females of that iconic species, that's not a manufactured crisis. We have crises in the ocean environment. The condition of coral reefs, I mean, if you want to just look at our area, or if you want to look at the oceans in general, you don't have to manufacture crises. And so what do? When we have real crises, we shut down the government. I mean, that's nuts. That is nuts. But that's the condition we're in, and there's no end in sight. I don't know. Usually I could predict. I used to be in politics. You know, I was mayor of New Bedford and stuff. I know a little bit about politics. How a shutdown might end. I have no idea how this shutdown ends.
Yeah.
And so it is so discouraging to see when you have so many indicators, loss of sea ice, the Gulf of Maine warming faster than any other body of water except a little body of water off of Japan, and what it means to the people who we asked to put food on our table, fishermen. You know, fishing is an honorable profession. It's one of the most dangerous professions outside of the military that there is. And we ask these fishermen to go out, you know, now, this season right now, off of George's Bank. It's not a great place to go earn a living. As Mayor Mitchell, the mayor of New Bedford, whose grandfather was lost at sea, as he said, it's a profession where even the commute to work is something you don't take for granted. We ask people, fishermen, to go out under these very dangerous conditions and catch seafood, best protein, wonderful to eat, under very rigorous laws. The Magnuson Act is the toughest laws in the world. And incredibly complicated. And then what we in government do when fishermen finally understand them is we go change them, just to make it even more difficult, right? And 99% of fishermen comply as best they can with these complex, tough laws. And then you introduce climate change, which, you know, has fish moving, which has the oceans acidifying, which makes it difficult for anything that's taking carbon and trying to make it into calcium carbonate for their shells, makes it really tough to do that.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's in that context to say that we don't want all hands on deck. Heck, we don't want to even have any hands on deck, is grossly irresponsible.
It's interesting, right? I mean, we have a situation where 3 billion people across the world are relying on sea protein as their major caloric intake. We take it as a given. We take that these things are going to mainstay. When we were kids, and you were a few years older than I, when you were a kid, people didn't think twice about it. The ocean was just a vast resource that will end. And we've seen the vast tragedy of the commons associated with that, depending on the trophic level of the species. Do you think in recent time, even in the last couple of years, between even small starter points of straws in the oceans, plastic floating islands, acidification as you're speaking to what we've seen for the bleaching of the coral, that people are awakening to these situations. And I'll even play devil's advocate and say, boy, maybe we needed this kind of crazy government situation where it's a band-aid that had to be ripped off, and this will get us thinking differently about these vast problems.
Well, that's an excellent question, and I think you have to segment the answer to it and say what people care about it. As you pointed out in your introduction, 50% of the people live close to the coast. A key question is, do you know where your food comes from? And every time I get an opportunity like the one you're giving me to get near a microphone, I always try and say, you should know where your food comes from. It doesn't come wrapped in plastic in a supermarket. And whether it's beef from a farm, I grew up on a farm. You know, we raised chickens and beef on the farm I grew up on. I scrubbed chicken shit off of eggs before I went to school. It at least gives you a sense of where your food comes from. And the agricultural community is ahead of the fishing community in terms of educating people about locally sourced food and how, if you pay attention and if you ask that question, you're supporting your neighbor. And the argument that locally grown food is not just better, healthier, tastier food, but it also is community building. The fishing community is starting to get there. And they're starting to say, we have the technology with barcodes to locally source fish. And people are willing to buy not just food, but a story. Mm-hmm. So that if you can attach a story to the food, people are interested in that. It's in its infancy, but people in the fishing industry are starting to do that. There are some community-supporting fishing efforts happening. Not enough. It's not growing fast enough, but it is beginning. And just as there was, it has taken off in agriculture, it will take off in fishing because it works. And there are other lessons from agriculture. I mean, fishing is still primarily hunting and gathering. In agriculture, we stopped relying on shooting bunny rabbits and squirrels a couple hundred years ago. We're still primarily hunter-gatherers in fishing. I mentioned that in fishing, in the region that I was responsible for up until a year ago was Canada to Cape Hatteras. The two big money makers were lobster, 500 million, scallops, 500 million. Scallops are what make my hometown of New Bedford the number one fishing port in the country by a long shot. You can't even see number two, which is in Alaska, because of scallops. Number three in wild harvest is blue crab at about 80 million. So it's a long way to number three. But aquaculture in my region is 267 million. So, and growing really fast. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that's fascinating to me is when I'd go to an aquaculture meeting, the average age would be about low 40s, high 30s.
Yeah.
Whereas when I went to fishing meetings, the average age would be more like my age in the 60s, 70s.
Yeah.
And not because anything we were doing in the federal government other than some science, but because people were seeing that, hey, aquaculture is opportunity. And Maine and Virginia were the two big states with aquaculture, Maine and salmon, Virginia and oysters. And it's just growing. But again, it's something in beef we figured out a couple hundred years ago,
yeah.
And starting to figure out in fish now. But I think that that figuring out where your fish comes from is a step in terms of who cares about it. And so one constituency is who cares, the consumer. Another constituency is a political constituency. And there you look at, well, you have the coasts. They care. But there's a big part of America, you know, Aaron, that isn't the coast.
Hmm.
There's a big part of the middle of the country that don't care about fishermen. And the chairs of a lot of important committees are in the middle of the country, and you say fish, and they say, oh, yeah, what about them?
That's right. We don't have a national food plan. We have a farm bill, which is half a trillion dollars, but never includes anything to do with fisheries, never mind aquaculture, which is farming a sea protein here.
That's right.
So let's talk a little bit more about that, because I think it's key as we have seen this. And I think in the consumer's mind, we think aquaculture. Most folks think like the land-based salmon-type approach, usually three-dimensional approach to like a CAFO environment, lots of antibiotics. But what we have here in the Northeast is very different. We have shellfish producers all up and down the East Coast that are actually doing regenerative ocean farming. We're really investing in these things. But what we have seen, which is interesting, is that that's a whole new crop of different individuals coming into this. And in the mind's eye of many of our fishermen, they're not farmers. They don't want to touch farming. So how can we get more fishermen who are currently doing the job to invest in raising fish and to migrate from that hunter-gatherer approach and to get into vertical integrated harvesters, to get something where they can control their own destiny, to leverage what you were talking about, that, look, there's miroir here. There's some values of my region selling to the people that care about this stuff.
I think that's I think the way you don't do it is say, you have to go do this, because fishermen are incredibly independent-minded. And believe me, I'm a former regulator. The last thing they want is regulation. That's why they go fish, is to be out at sea where they live by their wits, where there's no one around them. And that's why I have such incredible respect for fishermen. They're out there. And but I think they, you know, if they're there and they see the guy with a brand new pickup truck and they say, where'd you get the pickup truck? Oh, really? Aquaculture? What's that like? Well, I'm out on the water. I'm dealing with fish. Really? You know, that it's that kind of conversation that is a gentle conversation. You're working with fish, you're working on the sea, you got a new pickup truck, you're making money. That draws a person in as opposed to compels them in. When I worked my first tour at NOAA, I did economic assistance for distressed fishing families in New England, Gulf of Mexico, Alaska, Pacific Northwest. And we had fishing industry grants, $9 million, and half of them went to aquaculture. And some of the grantees said, I'm going to do aquaculture only until I can go back and do wild harvest. Others, I remember talking to one guy, I think he was on the Cape, who said, you know, I used to be a wild harvest fisherman, and every fish I took out of the sea, I felt I was diminishing the resource. Now, I feel like I'm harvesting what I sow. It's a whole different attitude, John.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm so glad I made this transition. Now, I'm not saying one of those is right or wrong. Everyone's different. But that second conversation was a person who is making that transition and is going to stay there. And so you find people with that second attitude, they're going to move into aquaculture. And there are people like that. And there's also people who are looking at that pickup truck saying, I want that pickup truck.
Interesting. The internal advocacy of their brethren of who've made this transition, folks they trust, folks that they have been involved in this, can help them see the light much quicker than some regulatory force.
And it's not just the guys who go to sea. I mean, I was talking to a guy who builds traps in New Bedford, and he says, don't tell other people, John, but I'm making a lot of money in aquaculture.
Yeah.
I do both, wild harvest and aquaculture, but I'm making a lot more money in aquaculture now on these aquaculture traps.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
Well, it is an opportunity for us to think differently around fisheries, and to the point when we do start to migrate some of the appropriation or resources that we've seen in terrestrial-based production models, and where we've gone to commoditize so many of those, but we're actually trying to coax it back to the middle of doing a more of a biomimetic approach to things, we can see the same light happening within fisheries, where many of our shellfish producers, mussels, oysters, bay scallops, or even what's happening with sea greens and seaweed turning into what an opportunity. We have an extractive-based model here. It's a secondary revenue stream. It's a complementary opportunity for lobstermen to grow these on traps, which they do already.
I think, Aaron, when the wind turbines get established, right now, the fishing industry in wind is characterized by potential conflict and an awful lot of conversation, active, productive, meaningful conversation happens, as happened with deep water wind in Block Island, where through the SAMP, the Special Area Management Plan, there was really good listening. Deep water wind listened to fishing. They reduced from 6 to 5 the turbines. They moved the turbines based on what they heard from the fishing industry. They hired fishermen to do scientific surveys. They hired them to do servicing. And the fishing industry and deep water wind have a really good relationship around that project, because there was very good listening, and what they did with the listening was to change their project.
Right.
So you can have a good relationship if you do good listening and you change based on what you hear. New Bedford has a offshore wind terminal right next to fishing, and the mayor there, Mayor Mitchell, says we can do both, and we can do them right next to each other. New Bedford has always been in the energy business. They didn't kill whales because they wanted to kill whales. Whales were oil. It was the motto of New Bedford, Lucem Defundo, was we spread the light. It was the energy business, and that's what they want to be in again. And they feel they can coexist, but only if there is give and take. Assuming that there is give and take and they work out the transit channels and all the other things that they have to work out, when those turbines are located there and you have fixed structures embedded and the wind energy folks can take a deep breath and say, okay, we've gotten through all those regulatory hurdles and everything else, and now the turbines are spinning, and now we're making money, and now we can take a deep breath. And we've got boats going back and forth servicing them. Those are ideal platforms for aquaculture because they're protected from mobile gear. They're already got boats servicing them, and you're just going to the wind developers saying you want to make some more money.
Right. It's the return trip and logistics.
You got it.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about New Bedford. I found it, first of all, very interesting, right, because the wind is a good scenario, because what's hindered wind often for too long has been the NIMBY crowd.
Right.
And same with aquaculture. People looking at, but that is a mindset that is absolutely changing. Bill Mook came on and explained to our audience that, you know, that might be an issue with the person that currently owns the house up in Demerscott, up in Maine, but the person that's going to buy it from him, not going to be the same. It's going to look at it differently. But New Bedford, by the way, my mom grew up in New Bedford.
Really?
Purchase Street. I spent many summer days down on West Island. My grandfather owned a pizza joint out there for a long time. So there probably was some crossover with the Vercellone family, the Vercellones, that you might have known them back in the day. But let me read a little more of your background and some of the work that you've done with NOAA and then being the mayor of New Bedford. So as regional administrator for the greater Atlantic region of NOAA fisheries, John Bullard helped manage 44 fish stocks, including scallops, lobsters, which according to NOAA, and as you had mentioned, are worth $500 million each, making them the largest besides probably up in Alaska. It's got to be, what, Dutch Harbor? It would be the only other one that competes?
Yeah, but that's in weight, not in dollars.
Okay. During your tenure, Bullard oversaw efforts to reduce the entanglement of marine life in the Atlantic Ocean and helped develop strategies to repopulate rivers in New Hampshire, Maine, and Massachusetts. In 2016, John approved the Mid-Atlantic Council's Deep Sea Coral Amendment, and which protected 15 deep sea canyons totaling 24 million acres. Additionally, and probably what a lot of our listeners are familiar with, is some of the work that you did with investigating and prosecuting notorious fisheries mob boss Carlos Rafael. Let's talk a little bit about that, because I think, you know, in listening to you speak about your respect for fishermen and listening to, I've seen you in other video publications talking about this, it seems you get a bad rap here. I mean, they're looking at it without coming in, from my understanding, my appreciation, that you're actually fighting for them. When you've got someone that's blatantly destroying the rules, maybe a bit of an analogy of the guy in our Oval Office right now who is out to cut off his nose despite his face and only looking out for their own vested interest, that person's got to be taken care of so the rest of us have these opportunities in the open cod fisheries. So can you share with our audience a bit more about what happened with the cod father, with Carlos Rafael?
Sure. Well, I didn't prosecute him. Andy Lelling, the U.S. attorney, did. And all credit goes to Andy and the IRS and the Coast Guard, their team. No enforcement work with them, but that enforcement action was great credit to all the enforcement people. I've known Carlos for decades and decades, and he is an unabashed, unapologetic crook. And he's not a fisherman, he's a crook. As I said earlier, 99% of fishermen are honest, hardworking, honorable people. And one of the things that sickens me is that a person like Carlos can bring dishonor to this honorable profession. He didn't care about the fishermen who worked for him. He didn't care about the people who worked in his processing plant. He didn't care about the city of New Bedford. He didn't care about anybody but himself. Yeah. And I'm very grateful to all the enforcement people who brought the initial criminal action against him, the people at NOAA who are continuing to bring civil action against him. You know, he gave himself the name Codfather. He bragged about how, you know, he was a crook and it was our, meaning the government's, job to catch him. Well, we did, and more than once. And so he's in public housing now, and which is where he belongs. But the thing that bothered me a little bit is that a lot of people in New Bedford said, well, as soon as we caught him and put him away, we, again, I mean the government,
right.
Everyone who worked for him, you know, should be immediately free to go fish, as if Carlos was the only bad apple.
Right.
And I said, that's what it's like if the government put one mafia guy away. I never heard people say, well, as long as you put one guy away, you should let everyone else in the mafia go free because they're all pure as the driven snow.
Of course.
Carlos was the head of a criminal enterprise. Yeah. Anyone who thinks he was the only bad guy, right. That seemed a little naive to me.
He had his own cabinet that he put together of like-minded individuals.
Yeah. So I think that, I think there are a couple of points to be made. One, the great majority of fishermen, and I mean it, I think it's 99%, 98%, whatever it is, it's way up there, are people who adhere to very complex rules. I remember, I think I was down somewhere in the Chesapeake, and a captain in the Coast Guard said, John, I want you to hold this book of regulations. And it was a foot thick and it weighed a lot. And she told me, this is what I have to carry with me when I board a fishing boat. I have to carry this 20 pounds of regulations when I get off of my inflatable raft onto the boat, because I've got to carry all the regulations. You see how much it weighs? This is what I got to lift when I get off my rigid inflatable onto the boat. Don't you think you could make these regulations a little bit thinner? So the Coast Guard's telling me they're too complex. So I understand how complex they are. They have to be, because when you think about how many species there are, how many ecosystems there are, how many different gears there are, they have to be. And yet fishermen do their damnedest to comply.
Yeah.
And so that's one point. And the other is, Carlos and a number of its captains, are bad actors, very bad actors. And they don't just steal from the resource. They steal from honest fishermen.
Right.
You know? They're ripping off their fellow fishermen.
Yep.
And so I congratulate all the people in enforcement. You know, when the people who spooled out a net while the Coast Guard was boarding them at high speed, they put those Coast Guard people at risk of losing their lives. So I have no sympathy for these guys. None.
Yeah. Has Robert Mueller reached out to you to talk about how you took down Carlos?
I didn't take him down. I did not take him down.
I understand.
U.S. Attorney Andrew Lelling took him down.
Well, look, I think it comes down to now is he managed a great deal of the quota for the region.
Yeah.
So what happens to the quotas? Where do we head now?
Well, I think that that's still... NOAA is still pursuing that in a civil action. It does, the wheels of justice grind slowly, but they grind.
Okay.
And they're not grinding now, though, because we're in shutdown.
27 days worth and no end in sight. Let me just read this, because I think it would be interesting for our listening audience, and I'd love to get your perspective on this. So prior to being the regional administrator for the Greater Atlantic Region of NOAA, John Bullard was the past mayor of New Bedford, as we've talked about. Sounds like that was your native hometown. You had a spot with the Clinton administration, as you mentioned. You were president of the Sea Education Association, and you have a BA from Harvard and a master's in architecture from MIT. Very interesting dude. And from our conversation, I'm getting a lot of that. How did this background lead to a passion in fishery and ocean health?
Clerical errors, my best answer to that one. I I studied architecture as an undergraduate at Harvard, and then graduated. Actually, it's my 50th reunion. During the strike, famous strike at Harvard, and decided during that tumultuous time that I wanted to save the world. I'm not the only person who decided they wanted to save the world, but I was one. And I was 4F. I didn't have to go to Vietnam. I'm grateful that I didn't have to do that. I'm very cognizant that a lot of my contemporaries did not make it back, and I feel forever lucky. I took some time sailing across the Atlantic a couple of times, thinking about how would I apply myself in terms of wanting to, quote, save the world. And what I came up with is I wanted to save my hometown, make my hometown a better place. And it was a Saul Alinsky book, Rules for Radicals. He said, don't go to Watts. They don't need you there. Work on your hometown. And New Bedford was a city that had all the problems of any other place, lowest educational attainment in the 70s of any city in the country, 8.0 years, very high percentage of people who spoke a language other than English in their home, racial unrest, very high unemployment. It had gone from whaling to textiles. Textiles left after a very contentious strike in 1928. And when you lose the one industry of a one industry town, you become a, quote, diversified economy because there's nothing. And so what I found was that it had all of the problems, but it had no resources, because when you're a small-sized city like New Bedford of 100,000, when you generate a brain, the brain leaves. And bigger cities like Boston, New York, Washington have lots of brains. They have problems, but they have lots of talent. The New Bedfords, Gardners, Fitchburgs, Lynns, Lawrence, you know, you name all the small cities, they got all the problems, but they don't have the resources. So I said, I'm going to come back to my hometown. It's my hometown. My parents are, and grandparents and great-grandparents are buried in this cemetery here. I want to fix my hometown. And so I started work there. And I said, I need to get some resources and tools. So I went to MIT, and I got a master's in architecture and a master in city planning. And I said, what I'm going to do is... Saul Alinsky said, don't try and solve the toughest problem first. Work on one problem, then adapt. And so I started fixing up a waterfront historic district, 15 blocks. And I did that for 12 years. And most people specialize in a professional specialty, and then they change their location. I said, I'm going to specialize in a place, and I'm going to change my profession. So I did historic preservation for 12 years. And then people said, now that you've fixed up New Bedford, you're going to go to Philadelphia or Washington and do historic preservation. I said, no, I'm going to stay here. And I changed from being a historic preservationist to being a mayor. And then when I was mayor for 6 years, they said, you're going to be a congressman or a governor. I said, no, I'm not a politician. I'm going to stay here. And I started working for the fishing industry, and I had to learn about fish. Just as I went from being a preservationist, I had to learn about, you know, dealing with cops and public education and learn how to be, you know, a mayor. Then I had to learn about fish. And then I did a little detour because Clinton got elected, and Gary Studd said, you should go join the Clinton administration. So I did that, and I had to change my definition of hometown. So, you know, it was a little 5-year diversion.
Broader
yeah. definition of hometown. But after 5 years, I came back. I worked at UMass Dartmouth after a little trip to the Kennedy School and started working for my hometown again. And so the architecture and planning at MIT was really just developing tools in terms of how to think about working from my hometown. And so in different times I've had to change or broaden my definition of hometown, but this work in fishing with Noah, as President John Kennedy said, the ocean doesn't separate us, it connects us. With that in mind, New Bedford, you know, connects to an awful lot of places.
Yeah, quite a lineage, and place matters. I mean, that, you're a Renaissance man in that, that I think that's been a resurgence in people looking at things where place matters, where you grew up, where you go hold your roots. It's a game changer for many.
Well, I think there are a couple of lessons. One, presidential politics, mayors have a different attitude because Fiorella LaGuardia said there's neither, a Republican mayor of New York said there's neither Republican nor Democratic way to pick up garbage. Mayors tend to be pragmatic kinds of people. And, you know, we look and say we have to solve problems. I used to, at Conference of Mayors meetings, listen to mayors, and I'd know who was a Republican and who was Democrat, but you'd listen to him saying, I wonder if I can tell by what he's saying whether this guy's a Republican or a Democrat, and you couldn't. And then I had the good fortune of going to a meeting at the UN. There were three of us American mayors and three Soviet mayors, and we were talking about I think the defense budgets and stuff, and Carl Sagan came down and talked to us, and I'm listening to the three Soviet mayors, and all they're doing is criticizing their federal governments for spending too much money on defense and missiles and everything and not enough money on housing and streets and schools. And I'm saying, not only can I not tell the difference between Republicans and Democrats, I can't tell the difference between socialists and capitalists. Mayors are mayors.
Yeah.
And I don't know, John Lindsay was probably the last mayor who had even a chance of running for president, but it is a different outlook.
Yeah, that's great insight. I mean, it is, we've seen presidential candidates come from governor's locations,
right,
but not from the mayor's role, and you're right. You
got to manage. Mitch Landrieu and Garcetti are two that are being mentioned now. And I'd say one other thing, and that is about the ocean.
Yeah.
Then Crown Prince Akihito from Japan came to present his credentials to President Bush, the father. The one place he wanted to see was Fairhaven, which is the little town across from New Bedford. Mm-hmm. And the reason was that in 1841, there was a young boy, 11 years old, Manjiro Nakahama, who'd been marooned on an island in the Pacific with some adults. And Captain Whitfield, on a whale ship out of New Bedford, the Jonathan Howland, had picked him up, and he let the adults off near Hawaii and brought Manjiro to Fairhaven. And Manjiro had stayed there for 11 years and grew to adulthood, learned how to be a mariner, and sailed back to Japan, which was a closed nation at the time. And he was imprisoned because it was a closed nation. And when Admiral Perry went to open up or help negotiate the opening of Japan, Manjiro was the only person who had contact with the West. And so he facilitated that, and he became a hero in Japan, this young boy from Tosu Shimizu. And so Crown Prince Akihito and his wife Mishika came, and I got to meet him, and it showed Because I remember addressing some Japanese. I said, you know, in 1941, you had Pearl Harbor, 100 years later. It followed quickly, relatively quickly, by Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And it showed the two extremes of what we're capable of. And I said, I think the lesson is, if you look at people as fellow fishermen, you see what's similar about people. And if you look at people as nations, you focus on what is different about people. And I think there's a lesson there, and the ocean plays a big role in it. Because the ocean, when you're out at sea, is a common denominator, and the ocean makes you look at the similarities. And so the Earth, misnamed, it's not Earth, it's the blue planet. It's three-quarters water, all of it habitable. I don't know, 90% of life is in the ocean, which is why NOAA is such a great organization, because NOAA is what teaches us about the wet part of the blue planet, is what connects us to each other. And we know so little. We know more about the moon, we know more about Mars than we know about the blue part of our blue planet. And so, yeah, it's fish, but it's so much more than that.
Yeah.
And so anything that gets us to take care of the ocean, to prevent it from acidifying, to keep the plastic out, to keep the coral reefs from bleaching. When I went down to visit some friends in the Keys and went snorkeling on the reefs, I mean, I was crying to see what they look like. It is just so sad to see what is happening to our reef system, which supports so much of life. And the surprises on climate change are always in the wrong direction. We always find that, oh, ice is melting faster than we thought.
Yeah.
The water's warming faster than we thought. Everything is always a surprise. We don't have a lot of time.
Right.
We don't have to manufacture crises on the southern border. We got plenty of crises.
Yeah.
Anyway.
No, that was fantastic. And as you said, as our collector of environmental information sits idle and has been shut down for 27 days, it is a unique opportunity for us all to realize we have a lot more alike than different, and maybe that's the steps we can take. So, John Bullard, I can't thank you enough for partaking in today's conversation. I learned a great deal, and I know our listening audience will as well. So thanks for the time.
Thanks, Aaron, for the opportunity.
It was wonderful. Thanks.